Welcome back to another edition of Thinking Like a Lawyer. I'm Joe Patrice from Above the Law. I'm joined by Catherine Rubino.
Hey!
And Chris Williams. We're all you're Above Law editors. We would have this show every week to discuss the big stories from the week that was, or the week that's to come in certain cases in the legal world. But first, we begin, as always, with a little bit of small talk.
Small talk.
Yeah.
I love that part. That might be my favorite part of our podcast.
You know what my favorite part of the podcast is?
It's the reason I show up.
Yeah. My favorite part of the podcast is when I got through the introduction without being interrupted.
I like that you couldn't even let it go. I was trying to give you a birthday present.
Aw, thank you.
It is, in fact, your birthday week.
It is. Yep.
Oh, look at that. Look at that. Is that why you're wearing new glasses?
No, I'm wearing glasses so that I can read small print on my computer screen without the blue blocker thing. Like, as somebody who lives his life in front of a computer screen, that whole blue blocker thing is real, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's good to be back on the cast.
How was your trip?
Let's wait a second. I'm getting there. I just wanted to say thanks to everybody else trudging through the weeks without me. You are very loyal listeners. I don't know how you did it without my sultry tones, but I'm back now. So was still writing, but I was in Greece physically for like the last 2 weeks or so. And it was nice. The water was beautiful.
Nice.
I bought a bracelet for like $200 that has like, it's silver and has like some blue opal on it. You know, listeners can't see at home, but you know,
right.
Probably neither can y'all on the Zoom screen, but whatever. And got it for like €200. And then I went to a market like the next day and saw something that had more silver, more opal for like a third of the price. So I was like, oh, I got ripped off. So, which I think is a fundamental tourist experience, but it was nice. It was the only one I saw of the trip. So even if it was a higher price than what I could have got elsewhere, it was the only one I could have bought like it. So, but yeah, it was nice. The food was great. Came back, pants didn't fit like I remember them. Worth it.
Mm. Yeah. Meanwhile, I did another CNN hit late last week.
Very
so that
exciting.
Was nice. You know, a little bit more. Television's a thing that obviously I had done a little of like 10 years ago. So it's nice to kind of flex that muscle again. I had kind of forgotten how it worked.
Oh, that's awesome. Well, I celebrated a high holy day.
Mm.
It's the release of The Tortured Poets Department, the Taylor Swift double album. It
and
was a
with
surprise.
That, thanks for everybody for joining us for Small Talk.
Perfect.
There you go.
I did not actually play the sound if you wanted to say anything about it.
Well, it was a surprise double album. So I listened to the first one. I stayed up till midnight, even though I have a small child. I stayed up till midnight, listened to it once through. I was like, okay, I got some thoughts. I can go to sleep. And then at 2 a.m., she released another 15 tracks. So I felt like the whole weekend I was just playing catch up, trying to get my bearings on all 31 songs. So
also, to Catherine's credit, it dropped on a weekday, right? So you were still working.
Well, Friday. It was Friday night.
Still counts.
Well, it's Friday, so it's like Thursday night. So yes, all day Friday.
Yeah. So,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah. It's true. By
hardest,
the way.
Like, hardest worker at ATL, let it be known.
Certainly the highest post count that has been true for a number of
fair.
Years.
That's fair.
Yeah. I've never actually wanted to be a West Coaster until like we have midnight releases. Cause I was like, if this was 9 and the second album came out at 11, I would have been fine. But instead, I dragged a little on Friday.
There we go. That brings us to the end of our small talk session. Let's talk big news this week. The biggest news, obviously, is going to be that this is the beginning of the Trump criminal trial.
We should. Yeah. Have you not come up with a sound for Trump trial?
We do not have a Trump trial song. Sorry.
Well, there you go. Especially if it's like a generic just Trump trial, because there'll be 4 opportunities for you to use it within the next year or so. So we should think on that.
Okay. I will definitely.
It's a little homework for you.
I will definitely give that some time. This is the trial that is about, this is the trial brought in New York about Trump making book entries that were misleading, allegedly making improper book entries, which is in fact a misdemeanor. However, it is not a misdemeanor according to New York law.
It's in furtherance of another crime.
Furtherance of another crime, which is theoretically a law that's supposed to be there to prevent people from, you know, money laundering. But in this instance, it's being deployed as an argument why that he did this. He tried to pay off Stormy Daniels as a campaign, the Trump Organization giving that money and hiding it. What it was for was an improper campaign contribution to the Trump campaign, which, you know, and therefore that's a crime. And that makes this all a felony.
I think we can kind of colloquially agree that the term for this trial is the hush money trial, though, right?
Yes, I agree. There is an argument out there that, you know, don't call it the hush money trial. Call it the election interference trial.
It's too confusing because we actually have a January 6th trial theoretically coming up.
Georgia trial seems like actual election interference.
Right. That's what I'm saying. Like we have two of those. We have a federal one. We have a Georgia state one. This is the hush money trial. It's okay because this is the 2016 race, not the 2020 race.
I think we should. One of the cases needs to be called interference to election boogaloo.
Electric boogaloo. That's fair.
Yeah. One of them has to be called the trial just for that name.
Right. So I was going to say not calling this an election interference trial. I'm on the side of occasional guest on the show, Professor Rick Hassan, who wrote a really good piece, I thought, about how this case kind of gives a bad name to election interference. There are actually serious election interference claims, and calling this one election interference is
it's a financial crime, right? It's a documents case, which is okay too.
But the point is, there's going to be a jury.
We have a jury.
We're going to have a jury trial. It is, in my estimation, I don't know, like maybe I'll ask others. I think the jury, barring some like crazy jury nullification argument, and that was a wrinkle this week, but barring something like that, I don't see a scenario where the jury doesn't convict, and that's not, you know, that it's preordained. It's just that the facts are pretty well established.
Yeah, there's a small chance that someone might say, well, he didn't intend or didn't know that the entries were being made the way that they were being made. I think that there's probably plenty to suggest otherwise, but that's kind of the only wrinkle.
Right. And I think that there are problems with this case, but Trump's going
statute of limitation.
Well, yeah, I mean, there are a lot of problems like that, but these are problems that Trump is going to have to win in an appeal before a judge. These are not fact finder problems. And that's why I think that probably goes that direction. That said, the lead up to the selection of the jury was exciting because we had Trump had some issues with sitting in court.
Well, he fell asleep multiple times.
Well, he did fall asleep a few times, which, you know, I will defend him on this. One thing that people don't understand if they aren't lawyers watch Law and Order is the court is incredibly boring.
Especially something like voir dire, which is what, you know, it was. There's a lot of downtime. There's a lot of there's just a lot of things that have to happen that do not involve you personally if you're the defendant.
All right, so we had some jurors. The jurors, we lost a juror because the amount of information that the media decided to publish about her was enough to identify her.
Some of the early, from day one of the jury selection, included like physical descriptions, like their haircut, hairstyle, you know.
Their exact employer.
It was a lot of information out there.
Yeah, I mean, We are not the sort of people who engage in trying to out jury members, especially in a climate like Trump creates for people through social media.
Right, which I think that Professor Vance at University of Alabama said it was like a mob trial.
Yeah. Yeah. That said, the information was, it was not hard to figure out who some of the people were.
Yeah, and one juror said that based on the information, at the time, juror, now former, said that based on the information that was out about her, that members of her family in social circle were like, is that you? Is that you? And it was enough to freak her out. And, you know, the judge gladly took her off the case as a result. And then the judge put some restrictions on what the media is able to report. Yeah. Anything that is not on the record. So anything they observe, like the physical descriptions, are no longer fair. And then the judge made some redactions to what was on the record and that folks would be allowed to report going forward.
Other issues going on, in addition to falling asleep, Trump complained that it was too cold.
Chilly. As someone who has had many employers where I kept a space heater permanently under my desk, my advice to him is, why don't you put a sweater on, sweetie?
Yeah, so he had that complaint. He did not stand up when the jury entered the room, which is a breach of decorum, but one that, I mean, I don't know.
I mean, I don't, I think that your take, and you wrote an article about that saying that, like, at this point, I don't think he's going to go up or down in the estimation of the jury. And I think that's probably fair, but it does show that he doesn't think it's very important, the entire process. And I think that could have some long-term sort of slow deterioration on the jury.
That we have a word. So you're suggesting that he shows some degree of contempt for the process, actually.
And I think that these are the sort of small things where it doesn't change, oh, I think he's guilty now because he didn't stand up, right? But it informs the juror's perspective of what he thinks about the alleged crimes, right? And I think that that does play a role into how they view his role in the, you know, payments that are the subject of the trial.
I mean, I definitely saw I believe it was Andrew Weissman, the former general counsel of the FBI, suggested that we're approaching a point where the judge may have to order Trump to cool down in a holding cell for a little bit because we're approaching those sorts of levels of contempt.
If it were any other defendant, I mean, even a potential former vice president, maybe. But I think that Judge Merchan probably accurately is trying to hold off on making Trump a martyr.
Right. Now, the last issue that's going on as part of this, as we begin opening arguments this week, is that there is still a gag order. Some of the things he has been, I won't say tweeting because it's truthing or whatever.
Posting
some of
on social media.
He is retruthing.
That's exactly what it is, though, too, right?
Right,
because
right,
it sounds like it's like making something that was false into a truth by some nefarious process.
So the government has pointed out that several posts that he has made violate the gag order. His response to this, as our colleague Liz Dye wrote, was, you know, retweets aren't endorsements, saying that, well, I was just reposting other people.
Bless his heart. Yeah, that's
other people breaching the gag order. So I technically haven't done anything. And it's kind of ambiguous if you think about it. We have not, as of this recording, gotten a response to that. I don't suspect that a judge is going to find it that ambiguous.
Yeah.
But
here we are.
Yeah.
In his bio, did he have the retweets aren't endorsements? Because then that absolves you of all responsibility.
It's like saying with all due respect, it gets out of everything.
No offense. Exactly.
Yes. Yeah. You know. Well, so with all that said, I was working on a joke in my head that it's not going to come to fruition.
Don't worry, this is not going to end this week, so you can work on it and come back next week.
Yeah, that's true. Yes. And meanwhile, of course, there's the question of whether the gag order itself is in any way constitutional, because, you know, Alan Dershowitz says that you can't have gag orders because Alan Dershowitz is just saying things these days.
Somebody puts a microphone in front of his face and he thinks of the most ridiculous.
Says
yeah, yeah. Just
like
whatever, like,
not really a
no thought process. It doesn't stop from like appearing in his brain and his mouth opening up. It just is a direct shoot.
Yeah. McDermott Will and Emery is Vault's number one law firm for associate satisfaction 3 years running. Why? Because they're doing big law better. McDermott is about achieving excellence together. Their culture is collaborative and inclusive. You can build your dream legal career at McDermott. They focus on mentorship with training and wellness resources to support you. 73% of associates earned at or above Cravath's bonus scale in 2023, all with a lower hour threshold. Want to see how your life could be better at McDermott? Head to careers.mwe.com/above the law.
Hey, Gee, what's up?
Just having some lunch, Conrad.
Hey, Gee, do you see that billboard out there? Oh, you mean that guy out there in the gray suit?
Yeah, the gray suit guy.
Order up.
There's all those beautiful, rich, leather-bound books in the background.
That is exactly the one. That's J.D. McGuffin at law. He'll fight for you!
I bet you he has got so many years of experience.
Like decades and decades. And I bet, Guy, I bet he even went to a law school.
Are you a lawyer? Do you suffer from dull marketing and a lack of positioning in a crowded legal marketplace? Sit down with Guy and Conrad for Lunch Hour Legal Marketing on the Legal Talk Network. Available wherever podcasts are found.
All right, so let's talk big law. The AmLaw 100 is out.
Yeah, American Lawyer put out the AmLaw 100 ranking. That is the ranking that's done on gross revenue and based on the year before's financials. So this is 2023 reporting. And overall, the news is pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
Big Law had tremendously great 2020s and 2021s, by and large, the industry. 2022, however, not great.
Lockdowns, lots of money. No lockdown, money fell.
Yeah.
Just so people are tracking.
So this year is kind of a very much a rebuilding year. There's been pretty steady growth in revenue for the majority overall, for sure, for the industry, but certain firms have seen decreases. One of the firms have, you know, increases that offset that.
Well, I was just going to say, we loyal readers and listeners probably, but definitely readers, know that there are a few firms out there that have been either directly or kind of indirectly by leaking it to journalists, mostly over at American Lawyer, saying, oh, you know, we're going to have more layoffs. Layoffs are coming. You know, times are tough, whatever. Those firms, we always suspected were outliers. These numbers suggest they were, in fact, outliers. Mm-hmm. Most of these law firms are making money hand over fist. And the ones that have been, you know, whinging about money are probably firms that have some actual issues.
Yeah. Overall, gross revenue is up almost 7%. Mm-hmm. So that is a very healthy percentage that is, you know, very much in line where, you know, kind of the pandemic had a high blip and then a low kind of correct it. But if you assume kind of like the 2018-2019 line, I think we're very close to where we should be. So that's good news. All good news. And, you know, other kind of interesting tidbits, mm-hmm. I guess, is we have a firm that has crossed the $7 billion mark.
That's a lot of money.
That is a shit ton of money. Mm-hmm. It is 0 points to get this firm right because it is incredibly obvious if you follow Big Law at all. It is obviously Kirkland, who has taken over the number one spot in the gross revenue rankings pretty consistently over the last few years. The other, oh, there we go. Yeah. I like that one. I don't know.
It moved from where it usually is on my board. That's why I didn't have it as fast. All right, go on.
But when you kind of get into some of the other metrics, and this is not, I mean, revenue is kind of the overall how we rank the AmLaw 100, but there's other metrics that they put together over at ALM. And one of them is people say perhaps the most indicative metric of whether or not a firm is doing well and how well they're doing is revenue per lawyer. Like, how much cash are they getting for every single associate that they have?
Mm-hmm.
Wachtell's usually at the top of this list. They are, again, with an increase of 20% over their already impressive 2023 numbers. That's over $4 million per associate. But the thing that really surprised me, and a lot of these kind of other metrics, you'll see a sudden increase by one player. That's Sussman Godfrey.
You saying they broke into the top?
There you go. Yeah, they're the number two firm when you talk about revenue per lawyer, and number four when you talk about profits per equity partner. But their RPL increase is 82%.
Yeah.
Something big happened for them last year.
Right. So now, of course, they were involved in the Fox Dominion case.
They sure were.
Right. and the other firm that was very deeply involved in that was, of course, Claire Locke. Claire Locke, though, did not take it on contingency. Made lots of money in fees,
but not an abnormal year for them.
Not enough to move them clear up to the top of the rankings. Right. This is very different. Right. Also, if you're interested, the New York Times has a fascinating breakdown of what happened.
What's
to Claire
going
Locke.
On behind the scenes there?
Well. But let's go back to Sussman. You know, this reminds me, I'm old enough to remember, I think it was Robbins Kaplan was like in the top 10 or something like that when I was in law school. It was like, why are they up here? And that was at the time.
Tobacco settlement.
They had been involved in the major Minnesota tobacco settlement, and that had thrust them very high. That said, so these things happen, especially for firms that do contingency.
Yeah, and I
work.
Think that, you know, if based on next year's revenue, you start seeing Sussman has tumbling down the rankings, I think that's not fair either. I think this is the abnormal year, and that's okay. But when you do things on contingency, you are more prone to those sorts of roller coaster ride sort of ups and downs as opposed to, you know, stayed hourly fees.
Well, this is the argument that people have had about Boies Schiller too, mm-hmm. is that, you know, when there were some partner defections to go to big law firms, there was some talk that, you know, the firm, its succession plan was in a weird place because nobody, you know, because Boies was pushing back against moving it to be, you know, kind of a traditional big law firm because he still wanted to pursue these contingency cases. And, mm-hmm. you know, you see that, you know, once again, also had a good year, has a good year lined up for next year, according to the firm, because they still take these cases. They have a good mix of doing defense work and these mm-hmm. sorts of big contingency cases, which is also Sussman's model there. And, you know, it works. If you have the stomach for it, you can actually build kind of a mixed model firm, not just plaintiff's work, which is obviously tons of risk with high upside, but also you can keep some of that consistent fee-based work too, if you're willing to really. Yeah, I mean, it strikes me as though that's a real skill for those firms balance that.
And I think that, you know, it's good that we have firms that are able to walk that line, and not every big law firm is that same kind of white shoe, quiet wealth kind of model, as opposed to some of, you know, the flashier, big name, big, you know, cases people want to talk about, non-lawyers want to talk about.
Yeah.
And I think that that's kind of a weird distinction, but it's true. Like when you're talking about like the Boies case back in the day, whatever, you know, those are the cases that people just wanted to talk about generally. Mm-hmm. It wasn't just for like the industry publications.
Yeah. All right. So last week there was another story that is a follow-up of sorts. We had already talked about how the National Judicial Conference, you know, which is headed up by the Chief Justice, but specifically in this instance, it was one of the committees headed up by yet another Republican judge from the Sixth Circuit, issued a rule saying that in the interest of promoting the random judge assignment, which is what all the federal courts agree is the way in which they can avoid the appearance of impropriety when it comes to forum selection, forum shopping issues, that if a case is seeking a national or statewide injunction, it should not be able to go to just a single judge division and avoid, you know, and get a one out of one chance of who the judge is, potentially somebody who exhibits bias. Because of that concern, they put out a rule saying that it should go to, if a case like that should go to a district-wide randomized wheel. Makes sense. Immediately, the Northern District of Texas, who's the district that we're all talking about specifically, it's not the only one, but it is obviously
About Judge Kaczmarek.
it is obviously the most striking version, sure. where you have a person whose job was to be a evangelical Christian advocate lawyer, like he that
right.
was,
and that's
that
where
was
the
job.
Abortion pill case came from, and he relied on questionable science in order to make the determination that he knows more about science than the FDA.
Right. But the Northern District then said, well, we're not going to follow that. So, okay. So they're just going to let
right,
that.
Because, I mean, you know, when you Why think listen? Commie pinko liberals, I definitely think of the Chief Justice of the United right, States right. Supreme Court.
So anyway, so they did that. Now, most advocates of this system have been smart enough just to say, we have the power to do this and we don't care. But Judge Ho of the Fifth Circuit has continued to try to defend the decision to allow this sort of egregious forum shopping. And he is not particularly bright, which means that his defense of it has been something of a disaster. We wrote about this. Jay Willis over at Balls and Strikes also wrote about it, like his story coming up like 30 minutes after mine or something like that. The speech that Ho gave is just, you should read the whole post about it because it is fascinating, but how somebody who is on the federal bench can be this bad at argument. But he tries to defend this with a series of just egregious dissembling, I think is the right answer.
I think that's fair.
Arguing that it's an assault on the idea that local poor local people in rural jurisdictions can get justice from a judge in their area. Does this overlook the fact that the plaintiffs in this case didn't exist until they were incorporated in that district moments before they filed this lawsuit? Doesn't really address that, which is a fairly glaring screw up and something that like somebody's going to point out. In this case, me, he made the argument that supermarkets, sometimes there's only one supermarket in a town. Does that mean that there's necessarily anything wrong with that? The answer, of course, is not necessarily.
But probably.
Not necessarily. Yeah. But we're not talking about the fact that this case was merely brought before this judge. We're talking about the case, the instance that multiple of these cases are being brought before the exact same person by people who are outside the district claiming to be in that specific division for the sole purpose of doing this.
Right.
These are issues. But the real crux of the problem for him is that he goes on and on explaining, and this was an issue the week of the forum shopping rule when it came out. He spoke then complaining about it, but he couldn't stop himself from just saying it was wrong. He then would pivot to, well, bankruptcy and patent cases have forum shopping problems too, which is a non sequitur to the extent that, okay, sure, they do too. That does not in any way mean that this isn't a problem. The idea that the judicial conference should be more aggressive about stopping these single judge divisions seems not to help his cause. If anything, I point this out kind of, you know, as a roundabout way, I was focusing on slightly different series of lies in the speech. but the balls and strikes piece hits on this exactly. His coverage of the bankruptcy and patent part makes a really good case for why we should have this rule.
just expand it. Yeah. Could also bankruptcy and patent.
He makes a really good argument.
I will say patent has been changed a lot because of some of the issues that were involved in forum shopping for IP cases.
So, yes, but it has been changed at local levels.
Yes.
They did not need a national rule like the Western District of
Texas.
Because
they were shamed into doing the right thing.
Western District of Texas.
Which is not something Kesmerick is doing.
Western District of Texas internally proposed a rule to fix the problem. Interestingly, do you know what that rule was? To make it a district-wide randomness,
this
specific rule.
Yeah.
But they did that for the purpose of getting around the patent problems that had developed in the Waco division. That said, he would argue, we have a practical example of how this specific solution works.
Mm-hmm.
So that's problematic for Ho's argument. But also, we have in that discussion a reason why the National Conference does not necessarily go all the way to expanding this to bankruptcy and patent,
mm-hmm.
which is they have some degree of faith that the local
actors fixing it, yeah.
can do this themselves. They don't have what's happening with this rule is they have lost faith in the idea mm-hmm. that these judges at a local level are capable of attempting to preserve the credibility of the federal judiciary writ large, which is why they tried to take action. And the response of the Northern District suggests that the National Judicial Conference was
correct
in its assessment.
It's
they really
went out of their way to prove this correct.
That this is exactly why why people do not have much faith in the judiciary as a branch, which is probably bad.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like a problem if people just
but you don't
trust
care if you're
courts.
Just trying to accumulate your own power, right?
Right. Yeah. So. Anyway, Ho has decided, rather than, you know, just kind of shrug it off, which is the right answer here, he has decided to put himself front and center of trying to defend the indefensible. The problem with defending the indefensible is that it remains indefensible. And what you really end up doing is proving that you are the very bright.
To quote our good friend Taylor Swift, you're the problem.
Yeah, okay. I mean, I think other people use that phrase too.
Yeah, when the to quote phrase is longer than the thing you're quoting, just say the thing.
Well, no. I mean, that's like Benjamin Franklin once said, no. Like you can't.
I'm the problem, it's me.
Okay, there. Yeah. See, now there, that's acceptable. That I get. But yeah, like one thing that I noted in the piece is it really reminds you of the shadow docket issues, right? Mm. Where the justices make all sorts of indefensible decisions all the time. And what they do is then just don't write anything about it.
They're like, mum's the word. Yeah. Yeah, we are doing shady shit. Shh.
Yeah, the whole point of having power and absolutely no accountability is to act that way.
Yeah. Yeah. Why even try to defend it?
Yeah. Anyway.
That's a great point. Just be quiet.
All he has to do is be quiet. But, I mean, he's the thirstiest guy on the federal judiciary.
Like he's walked through the Sahara for 10 years.
Yeah, thirsty. And he thinks that by hitching his name to every insane right-wing argument, he's bolstering a potential resume to replace Clarence Thomas or whoever the next opening is that is available to a potential Trump administration to respond. And to be honest, he's probably succeeded in that. I know there has long been kind of a Trump papabile list of people who could be put up. I think Ho has done everything.
I mean, if there is another Trump presidency and there's a Supreme Court vacancy during that time, for sure, Ho makes the shortlist.
Yeah.
Well, zero doubt in my mind.
Well, I mean, he's already the shortlist. I don't even see anybody as a close contender at this point. Like, Rao? Not anymore.
Are y'all assuming that Trump will respect loyalty?
Well, you know, I don't think it's about loyalty. I think it's about being the most bombastic voice out there. And this is somebody who's like, not only is bombastically defending pure insanity. Mm-hmm. And that is something that he likes. I mean, Kaczmarek is also somebody who could potentially get jumped up the chain, I suppose.
No, well, then Kaczmarek can get Ho's job, right?
Well, that's more likely how that goes. But
it's like everyone wins that way.
Rao? No. Duncan? No. Van Dyke? Like, when you go down the list of like loudmouth, questionably sound arguers on the circuit level or below, Ho's taken over.
Yeah, I also...
And he's young enough.
I agree. I think that he's... But I don't think it's a guarantee, because you never know who's going to have Trump's ear in that moment.
Yeah.
You know, because I don't think that Amy Coney Barrett exhibited any of those characteristics. She was just reliable on, I think, particularly the abortion issue, which is what they wanted for that. They wanted a woman to cast that vote and to replace Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
Oh, she was a mortal lock for that job.
Oh, I agree.
Like, the moment she was appointed to the Seventh Circuit, she was, if Republicans are in charge when Ginsburg dies, she gets that job.
Yeah,
like,
she got to that position without being that bombastic. People didn't write about her before she was a nominee or under consideration for the nominee. You know, sure, legal publications, but the mainstream publications are writing about James Ho because he says ridiculous shit on the reg.
I guess that's fair. But yeah, I think Ho still probably flies largely under the radar of the mainstream, but the legal side, we're all over this.
My money is on the judge that compliments his shoes the day that he gets to make the decision.
That's fair.
All right. I don't know. Like, all right, I'm continuing. No, like, and we know because he put up a bunch of people in his last administration that he probably didn't have any necessary love for, but are just like Leonard Leo told him so.
Sure. I think Leo might have different goals than Trump. I think that Ho is definitely playing to Trump, not to Leo necessarily, because for a lot of years, Leonard Leo played a very long game to get where he is right now, right? He doesn't just want the most outlandish, loud-spoken person to occupy all these positions.
I don't think that's true. I think he absolutely does. Anyway, well, with all that said, we won't resolve that in this short period of time. I think we've covered everything we need
for
today.
One comment on the article. The excerpt should have been the title. The excerpt is perfect. Judge Ho tries to explain why forum shopping is bad for patents and good for fourth births. Fails. Mint.
Yes.
That was golden. That was golden.
So a little behind the scenes.
Was the title. But I determined that I didn't think that that was going to have the SEO necessary to get it read.
Yeah.
But yes, no, that was the initial title.
Man, I felt it. That's
good.
Anyway.
I mean, I think it appeals to people who are ready for that, who are looking for that content. The question is, does it get picked up by people who may not necessarily know that
they
want that content?
The title used... What is it trying to attract? Cyclists? He delivers a tour de force and disingenuous bullshit? Come on.
Yeah.
people who are interested in bullshit. Yeah.
Yeah. People, yes. Primarily our audience is, something legal.
Something weird's going on legal. Yeah. And I think that gets that their attention, whether or not they are necessarily like in the mood for this exact article.
I think the words judge and fails do that, but c'est la vie.
All right. So with all that said, thanks for listening. You should be subscribed to the show, get new episodes when they come out. You should leave reviews, stars, write something. All of that is important. You should be reading Above the Law so you get these and other stories as they come out. You should be listening to The Jabot, Catherine's other podcast. I'm also a guest on the Legal Tech Week Journalist Roundtable. You can listen to the other shows in the Legal Talk Network on various social medias. We exist at ATL Blog, at Joseph Patrice, at Catherine One, the numeral one, at Rights for Rent, as in writing, not human rights for rent, but, you know, writing for rent. Over at Blue Sky, it's basically the same, except I'm Joe Patrice over there. And with all of that, we are now done. Talk to you later.
Peace.
If you're a lawyer running a solo or small firm and you're looking for other lawyers to talk through issues you're currently facing in your practice, join the Unbillable Hours Community Roundtable, a free virtual event on the third Thursday of every month. Lawyers from all over the country come together and meet with me, lawyer and law firm management consultant Christopher T. Anderson, to discuss best practices on topics such as marketing, client acquisition, hiring and firing, and time management. The conversation is free to join, but requires a simple reservation. The link to RSVP can be found on the Unbillable Hour page at LegalTalkNetwork.com. We'll see you there.